Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at centofinefoods.com, King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com, and Cola Vita at colavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the last February edition, 2014, Michael Michael's Real Food Show. No, not Real Food. That was yesterday. We were filming. Hey, I'm a couple of minutes late if you were sitting by the computer waiting for us. Sorry about that. Train troubles in New York City, which has been pretty common this winter. Anyway, great to be here. Lots of stuff going on. Got a couple of great guests today. I'll intro them in a couple of minutes. But we're going to talk the whole show, basically, about women in the industry, which is a phenomenon that's got a bunch of press lately for good reason. There was that lovely Time magazine story, Gods of the Kitchen, which for some reason seemed to think that that didn't include any women. I don't know how that happened. Ask the geniuses at Time. I don't know who the editor was that, but whoever he or she was, if they still had a job after that, good luck. And then there was a good piece on the positive side, a recent piece by Ed Levine and Serious Eats that got a fair amount of buzz, and Leah Cohen, the chef at Dirt Candy, who is a fervent blogger, sat down with a cup of coffee and just off the top of her head, I think the comment was, why aren't there more women chefs at these chef-y events that take place all over town for charity and often for profit? Which is true, it's true, it's true, and so Leah just sat down and off the top of her head rattled down about 20 or 30 women chefs in the industry that she could think of without even thinking about it. So anyway, we got a couple of women in here who are chefs in full in New York City. We'll talk to them in a couple of minutes. In the meantime, just a couple of things that are going on, what I've been up to, because I always forget to tell people this, and I'm getting emails like, you used to talk about where you ate for dinner and all that kind of stuff. So, okay, all right, you want to know where I ate for dinner? I'll tell you. I only tell you the stuff I like. Because I'll let the yelpers and the assholes bitch about things they don't like and mostly things they don't know about. That's not what I do. So I was at the Musket Room a couple of weeks ago. Great new spot. Well, not, I guess not that new. I wait for my MO with restaurants is I give them 6 months, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months before I even think about going for the first time. And then I give them a couple of tries because it's not so easy to open a restaurant. I think there's this tendency now, kind of fueled by the web, because everybody wants to be the first to have an opinion. And the web changed everything. It probably in the last, well, the first part of the last decade, I noticed that there was no more fair ground for when you went into a restaurant and wrote a review, even as a real reviewer. The New York Times used to give restaurants time. New York Magazine used to give them time. Everybody did. But because of the internet and things move so quick and everybody wants to be there, like opening night, friends and family, blogging, taking pictures, Instagramming, now the New York Times, you're lucky if you get 2 months before they come in and yield a verdict. And I say it takes 6 months to a year for restaurants to get their act together, usually. Even the real good ones. Just takes a while. Nobody's perfect out of the gate. But I really like the Musket Room. Great place, which is kind of, so it's on Elizabeth Street, right around the corner from Estella, which is another great new spot. I've always liked Frankie DiCarlo's Peasant down the road, so shout out to the folks at the Musket Room. Had a great, I'm an old world wine drinker, but I had some great wines there from New Zealand, so there, keep an open mind. And also, 2 stars for Dover in Brooklyn. Congratulations to Joseph and Walker. Those are hardworking guys. Nice to see that in the Times. Nice to see your review. And it's funny, because was it just me or was I sensing? I've been sort of railing about the Church of Brooklyn for a while, about this whole movement. That's great. It's cool. It's on fire. It is great. It's this whole youth movement in this borough that's fueled a dearth of restaurants, or excuse me, a wealth of restaurants, and manufacturers, artisan ingredients, from pickles to bitters to chocolates to coffees to handmade, handcrafted this and that. But as a restaurant scene, I see it as being really young. It kind of reminds me of like high school kids getting their shit together and thinking they invented the world. And I wish there was a little more seriousness in some of it. Actually, I had your old boss here, your new boss here, Saul. couple of months ago. He's a guy that I had great respect for on Smith Street when he opened up. Great restaurant, great story. I love the folks at Maison Premier. I've just thought that the Brooklyn thing, one of the downsides is it just tends to be the chef-driven experimental stuff with no front of the house and nobody who seems to care about the front of the house. And no one to edit the chef either, which is something that's not a great trend. But anyway, congratulations to Joseph and Walker for this 2-star review. That was great. A couple of shout-outs also for some community-supported fisheries. You know, I talk about fisheries here all the time, commercial fisheries. I live in Manhattan and Cape May. I'm really big into commercial fishing. And fisheries and local and sustainable and supporting them. It's crazy that in this country with these great fisheries like the Northeast and Alaska and the Gulf, we import 85% of the fish that we eat, which is just criminal because we have got great fish coming out of our waters. So there's a great new company just opened up, Maine Day Boat Scallops, just like that, MaineDayBoatScallops.com. Guys go out on scallop boats. Those boats go out for 4 or 5 days at a time, come back. They sell direct into Manhattan. I'm guessing it's FedEx overnight. But if you want to buy great scallops, they're not cheap, but they'll be dry and perfect and pristine, just like they'd serve them at a place like Marea, right? So Day Boat Scallops, MaineDayBoatScallops.com. Visit them. And there's another one out. They don't sell to the public, but Curry Heffernan turned me on to them. Dock to Dish, which is out on Long Island, that's selling restaurants in the city now, which is great. It's sort of a community of fishermen that are kind of cutting out the middlemen and selling directly to restaurants. Good for them. And one last shout-out to a restaurant that I've eaten at twice this week because I filmed there. So I went the night before we filmed to have a big, big meal. And then, of course, after we film, we always have an after party. Well, not exactly. Yeah, I guess it's that. It's the crew and me and friends and family, and we drink too much and eat too much and take over private dining and pretty much close the place. But I was at Rouge Tomat, Upper East Side. I don't know why I'm at the Upper East Side these days. Well, because there's some good stuff going on. Bettany's great up there on 57th Street, right at the beginning of the Upper East Side. And Rouge Tomat's this funny place, kind of under the radar. It's on 60th Street off 5th Avenue. Really super healthy food. The reason to be is to make really, really, really healthy food, to take out salt, to take out a lot of the fats if they can. Only good fats. They serve good fats, not bad fats. And not so many calories. It's really smart. If you don't know the place, read about them. I really, really liked it. And they've got a sommelier, Pascaline, who is just one of the best, most passionate somms I've seen in the city. She's part of this movement of female somms that have just blown up all over America. It really started in San Francisco in the 90s, and now all over New York you just see these great, passionate women running the wine programs at restaurants. Pascaline's great. She got into the game early. She's got a great palate. She's hardworking. She's super passionate, really into bio and organic. The wine list there is insanely good, and she's a pleasure to work with. You know, when you order food, you just have her suggest it, and she's always spot on. All right, so let me introduce my guests. Enough of me. Thanks for coming in, everybody. So my first guest is Lauren DiStefano. Is that right? No, DiStefano. Yes. DiStefano. Yeah. Sorry, I'm terrible. I'm Italian. You should shoot me for that right off the bat. Who most recently, you would have heard about Lauren because it was in the Diner's Journal or one of those New York Times things, Florence Fabricant. One of those things where I open up my web New York Times subscription online on Wednesday, and bang, we got a new executive chef at Marea. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
How long have you been with Mike?
Basically since Marea opened, so almost 5 years. Closing in on 5 years.
So you were, well, you might not have been there the day we filmed, but we filmed there a while ago.
Yeah,
so
I think I was there when you filmed, but
it's a big kitchen. You could have been huge. Upstairs, downstairs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And where before Marea?
Directly before Marea, I did some television stuff for Rocco DiSpirito. And then before that,
Rocco.
Rock on, Rocco. And then before that, I worked at 11 Madison Park.
Okay. With Carrie Heffernan or with Daniel?
No, with Daniel.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Cooking school?
Culinary Institute.
Graduated
2006.
Wow, that's meteoric. That's great. 06. So we're
post college,
huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and cook. When did you start getting into food? I'm just curious. I'm going to try and keep this interview sort of as much as possible gender non-specific, rather than like being interviewed like I'm going to interview female chefs differently than guys. So I ask everyone the same sorts of questions.
Great.
And I love the answers because some people are like, I was in college waiting on tables, or in my case, I asked my dad for money at 13. He was like, fuck you, get a job.
Yeah.
And at 13, it was like, wash pots, mm-hmm. pump gas, or deliver newspapers. Yeah. We used to have newspapers back then. And I did all the other two and hated them. And I got a job in a restaurant washing pots, and I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. Yeah. Like, all these old guys that were cool, and these salty old waitresses, and you're sneaking eclairs and shrimp, and you have cash in your pocket at 11 o'clock at night.
It's pretty badass.
It kind of was. And I wasn't the best student, so it was sort of like process of elimination.
Helpful, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you?
Since I was 8, I wanted to do this. My family's Italian and Spanish, and there was food everywhere all the time. And as Spanish and Italian families go, there's a little bit of fire surrounding everything. Yeah. So regardless of the arguments and the fights that were happening, when dinner was served, everyone sat down.
Yeah.
And I'm the youngest, and you know, my brother and sister spoiled me since the time I was born, so there's a large gap between us. So I realized that I could cook for them, and that was kind of the only thing I can do because I didn't have money because I was 8. So I can make them spaghetti and meatballs. And they couldn't do that for themselves.
So you were in the kitchen at 8 doing stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, I was lucky because my parents let me. They were, you know, supportive with that.
And from where originally?
Franklin Lakes, New Jersey.
North Jersey?
Yeah.
Yeah, nice neighborhood. Grandmom cooked?
Yep.
Yeah.
Both my parents cooked.
Well, you were lucky there. Yeah. You're a little bit younger than me, so maybe it skipped a generation. My grandma was amazing. I didn't realize it till later, but I think I became my grandmother at some point. That's all she did was live to cook.
Yeah.
I mean, she just cleaned the house, cooked. Yep. Her husband was a tailor. And
that was the same thing with me.
Two kitchens. There was a kitchen upstairs and a kitchen downstairs. The upstairs kitchen was like the show kitchen. Yep. Downstairs is where she was all the time, with her sleeves rolled up, rolling out pasta, burning peppers and peeling them, putting up jarred tomatoes. I mean, it was full on every day. Yeah. And it's funny because there's all this foraging that takes place now. And this was back in the 60s. My grandfather used to go. They lived in Philadelphia in the city, but there was a public golf course nearby. And he and his mates would go forage in the golf course and take home, pull mushrooms off of trees and dandelion and just stuff that I had no idea what it was that I was eating as a kid, figuring, I guess everyone ate this. But
yeah, the original farm to table.
Kind of by necessity. So with Mike for 5 years, started where when you got hired?
Well, Jared, I'm Chef de Cuisine. Jared Gaba is our executive chef. So he and I had worked together at 11 Madison Park. So when he had realized that he was going to be opening Mariah, he kind of brought me in as chef de partie of Garmager. So I kind of managed all of that stuff.
Which is big. So Cold Side's a big pro. I mean, is that where the fish was coming off of as well?
Mm-hmm.
All the crudos.
Crudo, oysters, the lobster salad that will never leave the menu, and Ricci Cristini, all that stuff.
Yeah, the uni. And do you still do the uni with the lardo
on
top?
Of course.
I dream of that freaking dish. You know, it's so I'm 57, came to New York in 82, and I was in my early 20s, started cooking at 13. And I will say that when I got here, January of 82, graduated the CIA, came and worked in good kitchens, the Four Seasons, the Maurice for 2.5 years with Christian Delouvrier, Widows in the World. I was a chef upstairs at the Cellar on the Sky. Then I was at Tavern on the Green for a while, the Ritz-Carlton. And there really were no women in the kitchens, like literally. And I was trying to think today, coming into this show, why. And I kind of think it's sort of simple, back then anyway. It's a blue-collar industry. You know, it was sort of like, the guys that were in it weren't like top-rung people. I mean, everybody I talked to with my generation was like a shitty student, dropped out of college, did drugs, and was into cooking by third or fourth choice. You wanted to be a musician, you wanted to be an artist, you wanted to be a playwright, you didn't have a trust fund.
Yeah,
you had to
pay bills. Yep.
Right, and even in the 70s when I was working as a kid, the kitchens were funny places in America. A lot of my chefs in Philadelphia, I don't even know if we called them chefs, it was just like the head guy, were just ex-Army, Navy, Marine kind of guys that wore T-shirts and smoked cigarettes, and we had wooden cutting boards with burn marks all around the sides. It was a TV set with the hockey game on. It was just something you did. It was extremely blue-collar, and if you dreamt big, it was to maybe be a chef someday. Mm-hmm. And then I came to New York where there were actual chefs. But these were all European guys.
Yeah.
And that's when I think that was kind of the resistance, that those men were pretty much blue-collar guys in their own way, too, because at 13, it was decided that's what they were going to do. Yep. Some of them were, you know, kind of drinkers and crazy men. And as women began to go to cooking schools, when I was in the CIA, we had women in our classes. I don't know how big my class was, but I remember 6 or 7 women in my class of 18 or whatever. But if you came to New York, it was garmanger or pastry.
Yeah.
That was it. That was like where you... And you almost couldn't go beyond that. It was like you could become a pastry chef, and I think that's kind of why we saw this great movement in the 90s and 00s of like so many pastry kitchens in New York being run by them. But it was like, I don't know what they were afraid of. If you were on the hotline, you'd explode.
Yeah.
Secret. I don't know. You'd faint. I mean, I couldn't figure it out. It was like, what's up with this?
Yeah.
And then I began to notice sort of this gradual change when I began to do the show 13 years ago of going into kitchens. So you went to CIA. What percentage of your class were women?
Maybe 25. I mean, it wasn't that high. There were still largely mostly men.
And that was recently.
Yeah.
Oh, because it's funny. The FCI in the city, maybe it's because Dorothy runs it. I mean, that's almost half women.
There's so many women. I mean, it's nuts. I think maybe now, and maybe as I was graduating, the numbers may have gone up more. But yeah, I would say it wasn't more than 30 or 25%. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, funny. All right. So that's that. The early days coming up, school, women. Did you find... Now I am going to get gender specific. 11 Madison Park's great. Daniel's an incredible chef. That was a great kitchen, a great turnaround. Did you find, and I'm sure you know other women in the industry, has gender bias begun to disappear? Has it disappeared?
People have asked me this before, and I myself have never felt any kind of gender bias. I think maybe because I just never thought I was different than anyone else. And if someone thought I was different from them, that was their problem, and I took care of it myself. But... You know, I've always worked with women that were fairly strong and were tough and were, you know, and someone asked me, you know, how many, have you seen more women go down than men? And I was like, no, because I've worked with decidedly less women, but I've seen a lot of men start crying in the line also. And I've seen less women start crying in the line. Now, is that a numbers game?
Right.
Possibly.
Right.
But I don't, you know, I think it just takes a certain mentality, and if some people definitely are intimidated by by just being out there, but it's not really something I ever recognized.
Yeah, and I think too, I'm going to go on this subject as much as I can with this show going forward for years with interviewing people, but in a way too, you were fortunate that you were in two great houses, because I have a theory that the philosophy of restaurants, the tone set at the top. Mm-hmm. So Danny Meyer in the example of 11 Mad, and not just Danny, but Hum, mm-hmm. who's just a gentleman and a great guy and a good guy, and Michael White's the same way.
Yeah,
Michael's a
absolutely.
Consummate pro. Whereas if you go a couple of rungs down,
might not be that way.
Yeah, into more of the hash houses, it's like a guy's locker room in high school football. Yeah. It's a bunch of jerk offs. You know,
I mean, but it's like that's disregard for what the final product is. Like.
Right.
You want the best final product. Who's going to make the best final product? And then it doesn't matter who's making it. It just matters who makes the best.
What gets you stoked these days? What's your schedule? What 8 hours? 10 hours? No, you don't work 10 hours.
10 to 12 hours
a day?
Mm-hmm.
10 to 12 hours a day. 5 days you get two off?
Yeah.
Good for you.
Great deal.
That's civilized.
Michael White's the best.
Yeah.
He's,
the industry's changed a lot. I mean, and it's kind of a good thing, because I think that I mean, I came up with 6 days a week. That's what you did.
Right.
And shut the fire. And you worked for 80 hours and you got paid for half of them. And
I'm
just like, you don't like it, kid?
Yeah.
There's like 20 guys right behind you who are going to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, some of the chefs' quid pro quo was in the summer. They'd give you an extra week off and they'd work for you,
mm-hmm.
or find someone to fill in. But it was crazy. So what time in the morning you come in?
Between 10:30 and 12.
Because you guys do lunch.
Yeah.
And it's busy.
Mm-hmm.
Full on.
Yes.
Crazy since day one.
Yep.
What's your day? First thing in what? Into the office?
First thing.
You're not on the line as much as you used to be.
I'm either, if Jared, our executive chef, is there, he'll be expediting, I'll be plating. But usually at night, I'm expediting and helping whoever needs help.
So on the other side of the pass, and when somebody gets in the weeds, you're back there slinging.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. All hands on deck when that happens.
Which I guess is brilliant. Now, another question that I ask everybody, because I find this has been a problem for really the last 10 years or so in New York. Maybe not so much with Mike, because of the Altamirea group and sort of you guys are in the spotlight, and every time you open up Eater or a magazine, it's one of your restaurants.
Yeah.
But do you find, because everyone else is telling me, they're finding it really hard to get qualified cooks. Forget gender. Just to get people to come in the door with their head down,
mm-hmm.
and say, okay, I'm going to work. Chef, I'm going to come in.
Mm-hmm.
I'll trail. I mean, is this something you're saying?
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
You know, again, for me, I think I was a little bit of a different scenario, because my parents made a deal with me that since no one in my family is in this industry, they were like, go to college, get a degree. When you graduate, if you want to go to culinary school, you can go. So graduation day came around. My dad was like, what do you want to do? I'm like, culinary school. He's like, all right.
Damn.
So there
That's
I went.
That's expensive. What
yeah,
college?
There I went. Fairfield University in Connecticut.
Yeah.
So,
great town.
Which was really awesome time. But I think, you know, when I went to culinary school, I had wanted to be there for so long
right.
that every second was like the best moment that I could possibly have. And I just took advantage of a lot of things. And even at that time, there were some students that were with us or in the classes before or after us that weren't really, didn't really have the same feeling around it.
I'm going to interrupt you. In 1982, same shit.
Right.
So 1982, you think, was a million years ago. I was a little older, so I cooked all through high school, went to college, dropped out of college, wanted to do something. Exactly, you went to the CIA, and I was stoked. I mean, I just wanted to suck every bit of juice I could out of things.
Yeah.
So if there was an AM guy that was better than the PM guy, I did both classes.
Right.
I would sit in on classes.
Yeah.
I would go up. We had a library in Roth Hall. I would go to the library and do. I was a kid in a candy store. I was going to get my dollars out of that thing.
Yeah.
But I found that probably 2/3 of the people in our class were just like, "What the fuck are you doing here?"
Yeah.
All right.
Just so don't get it.
Back to the answer. Your answer.
I personally, and this is something I've been talking about with our fellow sous chefs and some of the chefs from across our companies or other properties, is that it's not the same. If we were at 11 Madison Park in 2006, the caliber of cooks that we'd be getting in compared to now, and I use that example because that's where I was,
right,
are totally different. You wouldn't be getting in
better.
Just more experience. You wouldn't be getting in 10 cooks coming in for a trail that had just graduated culinary school the first week in February. It's unheard of. It's not necessarily a bad thing. But it's really about the personality and the work ethic of the person as much as you can glean from one day trailing or staging in a restaurant, which sometimes isn't exactly the best scenario.
Right. I mean,
they're on the best behavior. They're doing everything right.
Right.
It might not be how they actually are. But for us, it's more about teaching them how we operate, teaching them how Michael White runs a kitchen, teaching them our culture, and just trying to bring them up in that atmosphere. I have no problem teaching someone how to make a proper mayonnaise, how to make a proper hollandaise, how to,
anything. Somebody taught you.
Poached lobsters.
Someone taught you, you'll be generous and teach back. I mean, that's what we're supposed to do.
As long as they're receptive and they're going to take it in and they're going to expound upon everything all of us are teaching them, that's great. And we have the prime worker that we want, that can go on to any of our other restaurants or go on to a new restaurant opening and really help represent what we're trying to do in this industry. So, but I think absolutely hands down. And I think it's also kind of, there's been a lot of talk of it's expensive to live in New York City.
Yeah.
It's really expensive. And before it was like, that was the place you had to go. But now there's these people opening up in North Carolina and Georgia and Alabama, and they're doing this whole New York mind food in a place where you never thought would be possible. And they're maybe not making as much money as they are here, but they can live a better quality of life off what they're making. So,
yeah, that's the trouble with turnover. I mean, there's, I guess, two questions that you sort of addressed.
Yeah.
And one is, you guys have a big organization, so you must be constantly looking.
All the time.
Because you're expanding. I mean, you just opened up Osteria Marini on the Upper East Side. I heard you bought the Old Post Inn or one of those gorgeous properties on Westchester or something. I mean, everyone's fear of Michael is he's getting too big too fast, and at some point the thing's going to be like, kaboom.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, he's a smart guy, and if you can get the infrastructure in place, he's not the only guy that's done
it.
I mean, Danielle did it in a slower pace, and John George has done it, and to a lesser extent, but in some ways, Keller. But so you guys are looking for cooks all the time.
All the time.
And the turnover rate must be huge.
I have to say, in my experience especially, the culture that we provide in our kitchens, because of the way Michael White operates, is unlike any other culture I've seen in a kitchen in New York City. There's no yelling. There's no screaming. There's no throwing anything. There's no demeaning someone. It's not uncommon to hear him say, "It's just food, guys. It's just food," and then crack a joke to someone and then get next to them and make the pasta they're supposed to make and then put it in a plate and send it out, which is great for everyone to see. I think that's definitely kind of the reason why it's all sticking together and why it's every spot that opens up is doing as well as the one that opened before it, because he's such a strong force, and he's there. He's on the line with the cooks. He's coming in and checking in.
Is Maria still home base?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay,
whenever things get crazy and someone's looking for Michael White, he's usually in the Maria kitchen making some fusilli for someone or something.
So you've had a remarkably quick ascent, and you've worked in two of the best kitchens in America, really. I mean, 11 Madison is its own little world of tweezers and microplanes and, 18-pan pickups. Mm-hmm. But it's really, you can't argue with the results. The food's amazing. 4 stars from the Times, 3 stars Michelin, and Maria just, really in that same ballpark. One of the great seafood restaurants in the country up there with anybody you can compare it to, Bernadette et al. and 7-8 years at a cooking school. That's crazy. So what would, not gender non-specific, what's your advice to young people that are thinking about this industry or are in maybe in cooking school now?
People make fun of me sometimes because I do often liken this to playing sports. You know, I play competitive sports my whole
life.
Why
not? I mean, it's been,
I know,
that's
right?
been my line of fears. It is. So I'm going to shut up. I asked the question. I'll let you answer it.
Well, I just, you know, I play competitive sports my whole life. And it's, if the coach tells you to run 5 laps, you run 5 laps. You don't look at them. You don't make any kind of remark or like facial expression. You just do it. And that's something that's kind of missing from what we're getting now. And it's, and you hate to bring it back to that because no one really enjoys that per se. But I, for cooks nowadays, it's just do what you're trying to do. Keep your head down. Do the best you possibly can. If someone asks you to do something, do it. Know what your position is in that kitchen and know that if you find the right fit, because I think that's hugely important. If you find the right fit and you do the best you can, you're doing a great job, it will get noticed and you will move on. It's not about going to your chef and complaining about so-and-so next to you and whining about this, that, and the other thing. You know, if this is what you want, no one's coming into this industry to make money as a cook. Let's just be honest.
It's so funny. I mean, this is kind of an industry insider show, so it's a shame this is, I mean, my old radio show was more of the general public, moms and dads out there, WOR, but it's the truth. I mean, I think, I mean, maybe at the very top, there's money to be made.
Right, so as you ascend the ladder.
Percent, yeah. I mean, yeah, and even for you, I mean, there's a glimmer of you were living better than you were a couple of years ago, but yeah, the truth is that this is not, that is, if that's your primary motivation, don't even think about
no,
it. Forget
what are you
about
doing?
It. Because you'll be lucky if you ever get there.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily what you see on the Food Network and
it's not necessarily.
Yeah.
It's totally, I mean,
it's absolutely not. I mean, let's just be real. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, I also think, and I'm on the media side of the equation now, kind of by accident, but I also think that that's kind of one of the problems with young, all this interest in cooking is because of like the Cooking Channel and I guess my show too. People look at this and say, wow, that must be fun.
Yeah.
You get to hang out with all these chefs, you go out, you have a Negroni every night, you're drinking great wines with dinner, you're hanging out with these, this is a party. I went in on that and it's like, excuse me. Sorry, I won the fucking lotto.
Yeah.
The truth of the matter is, here's the deal. You're going to work 5 days a week, get used to having burn marks up and down your arms.
All over.
I mean, I have a bone out chick. I still have a cut the other day that won't stop bleeding. You know, you're on your feet all day long, and you're going to be sweating in polyester for like the next 15 years.
Oh, it's so uncute. It's not cute. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And for you, I mean, it's interesting. Now you've been with Bianco for 5 years, and Mike is a work of... you know, force of nature at this point with the speed that he's moving and the successes that he's had. So, I mean, for you, the idea is stay there and at some point as, like Dan, like everybody else, as he's moving pieces of that chessboard around, you can only go up.
Right. And that's something that's absolutely a main theme or kind of cornerstone of the group they're building is that they would 100% rather staff from within and build all of these places for all of their talent to go and excel and do the best they can. And for me, this was my love of cooking was born out of such a wholesome thing, you know, next to my grandmother Christmas Eve making, you know, 13 different dishes for everyone, which I do now every year. And he had that same love. You know, if you, and I know you've talked to him about getting into food, he gets this whole, he's just so into it and he loves it. And you ask him a recipe from 1987 when he was in France and he'll pull it out verbatim, gram, spot on. It's crazy. And that's something that you feel good about doing because it's not just about making things look gorgeous on a plate. It's everything behind it also. So, you know, for me, this is the right spot for me. They definitely have made good on promises that they've made to all of us. And I love having a cook come in that, you know, you think shows promise might be a little feisty. Maybe you need to like sand some edges down, you know, it might be a little rough. And then they're going on to be a sous chef at like the next restaurant you're opening.
Right.
And it's kind of, you know, I don't have children, but it's like, it's like visioning my niece and nephew. I'm like, oh, my babies are they're growing up, you know? So it's great. It's awesome. And
what's your favorite thing about the job?
My favorite thing about the job is, I would say two things. One is when, you know, friends or family come and you get to go outside and it's maybe the first time they've been there and just seeing the look on their face, you know, the oh my God, this is awesome. So-and-so just called me by name. I'm like, yeah, I know. You're my mom, obviously. Like, but, and then also just having these cooks come in and working with them on something, and kind of you get a little, they get a little fear in their eye, and you work with them on something and you teach them something, and then you make a little joke and they're like, what? And you know, it's just that, that personal interaction with these people that you're hopefully helping them get to where they want to be.
Least favorite thing.
Well, you touched on the outfit. It's not cute. It's just not. It's never going to be. It's never going to be cute. Yeah, the hat is never going to be cute, no matter how many times everyone tells you, oh, it looks so adorable. You know, it's hard missing things. When you're close to your family, it's hard not being able to go to every birthday or holiday or things like that.
Well, that's the other thing with the business is that, again, for people like think it's a glamour, I mean, you are working when everybody else is off, literally.
Standing
nights,
the whole time.
Weekends, holidays. It's antithetical to a normal life. You are when they're off, you're on.
Right.
And even on the biggest days, it's like sacrosanct, like Friday night. Fuck no.
Yeah.
A holiday weekend? What are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And I see that. I mean, I hear from chefs all the time. That's what, you know, these young kids coming out of culinary school, like asking, like, can I go to a concert next Wednesday? It's like, what?
Nobody cares.
This is your life. Don't even look at bands in town. Don't even look at the. Forget about it. You're not doing Ticketmaster. Yeah. Just disconnect that little
plan. Plan nothing.
Yeah. Hey, well, great, Lauren. Great to re-meet you. I'm sure I met you along the way.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Congratulations to you. Say hi to Bianco.
Thank you so much.
The team over there.
Really,
I know.
It.
And you have to get back because you got service to do tonight.
I do. Yes.
And you probably have like 250 on the books.
275 when I left.
I'm close. And then there's the walk-ins.
Very close. I mean, we're gonna hit three. So.
Another day in the life at Marais, and that's after a full turn at lunch.
Right.
Yeah. So go back, check your phone. Thanks for not checking it while you're with me.
Of course not.
And let me ask, side note, just how do you feel about like cell phones in restaurants, like people taking pictures of foods and texting and all that shit?
If someone's enjoying something and they want to take a picture of it, great.
Whatever.
That's awesome. But if you need to take a call, get up from the table and go. I mean, you know, my brother is a huge sports fan, so I grew up with him having, as soon as cell phones came out, checking his, you know, the Nets game, the Jets game, and then crying after, but his score on his cell phone. But if you want to take a picture of the food, that's great. But otherwise, just enjoy it. That's what everything's about.
Yeah, I know. It drives me nuts. If I can get people to agree with me, great.
Yeah.
If not, we edit you out.
Yeah.
Thank you. Lauren Estenos, congratulations
on
everything.
Thank you so much.
No,
thank
it's
you.
So
it's
great.
Been a pleasure.
It's so great you've done well. And again, hi to the whole team there.
Absolutely.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Mike Colomeco's Real Food on the Heritage Radio Network. Lauren is the chef de cuisine now at Marais, New York Times 3-star Michelin.
2-star.
Michelin 2-star and one of the great seafood restaurants, one of the great Italian restaurants, one of the great pasta programs. I can't say enough about it. It's Michael White's best restaurant. I love it. If I had the dough, I'd eat there all the time. Great place. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with my next guest right after this. Thank you.
Today's music is by Brothers NYC on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Any good chef will be honest with you and tell you about 80% of good results from cooking is good shopping. You have to start with great ingredients. So when I'm looking to make a canned tomato sauce at home, I use Cento San Marzano tomatoes, which I've loved using for years. When I had my restaurant, that's what I bought. When I was a chef at restaurants and I could supervise the purchasing, that's what I ordered. They're great. I actually had a chance a few years back to go visit the area where they're from because I'm always curious with ingredients. What is the provenance? So we flew in the middle of August to this little region just in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius where there's great volcanic soil. And what I found out was these tomatoes come from lots of small family farms, little quarter and half acre plots where that's what they do. They raise tomatoes and sell it to the Cento factory that packs this tomato in the peak of the season in the middle of the summer. Cento nourishes the San Marzano tomatoes from start to finish with 100% certified traceability program. Cento's San Marzano certification is the only one of its kind, assuring the consumer of authentic San Marzano tomatoes. So if you're looking for great canned tomatoes for great tomato sauce, look no further than Cento brand San Marzano.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Michael Lameco here. When I started my PBS show, one of the deals with producing a PBS show is you're always looking for underwriters, and I thought, let me start first by going after people whose products I actually use in my kitchen. I had a restaurant for years. I used Colavita olive oil. I did some research and found out that in the extra virgin category, it was the only Italian olive oil that was actually 100% Italian origin. There's a lot of stuff going on in that business that we don't really want to talk about, but a lot of the big brands call themselves Italian, have Italian flags on the labels, and their blends from tank farms from all over the planet. Pretty much based on price. Colavita is the exception. Really love the oil. Been using it in my house. Reused it in my restaurant. Well, Colavita is doing something neat. They're doing a contest. If you go to italycontest.com or colavita.com, where there's a link, but again, Italy Contest is the more direct way to do it. They're doing a contest on substituting butter for olive oil in baking goods. The winning recipe gets a free trip to Italy, courtesy of Colavita. So if you're thinking about cooking with olive oil and you're a baker, throw them your recipe at italycontest.com or visit colavita.com and click the link there. You may win a trip to Italy.
You call me, baby.
To Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. So this show, I devoted this whole show, I thought I would just talk about women in the industry because, again, it's been an interesting year. I've been in this business forever, and I remember when there really weren't very many, if any, in the industry outside of garmage and pastry. I've watched that change, and in 13 years of doing the PBS show for Channel 13 here, we have tried to make an effort to tell these stories. I remember, I think our very first season, we did a show with Ann Rosenzweig, who was one of the early pioneers with Leslie Revson back in the 80s and 90s in the city. Since then, we've filmed with Anita Lowe, Gabrielle Hamilton, Alex Raj, Missy Robbins, Sarah Jenkins, Jody Williams, April Bloomfield, Rebecca Charles, Amanda Cohen. I could go on and on. Heather Carlucci, Patty Jackson. Every season, we try and cover some kitchens where there's women at the helm. And I remember filming, three seasons ago at Avoce. And Avoce is a funny place because it was really Andrew, he hates to be called Andy. Sorry, AC. Andrew Carmelini's restaurant. And Andrew left, and a replacement came who I was not familiar with named Missy Robbins. She'd been in Chicago for a while. She wasn't on my radar. And, I kind of thought of that as Andrew's restaurant. It was his coming out party post Cafe Boulud. He got a great review. He'd left. I thought, when the chef leaves, takes the staff with him, it's not the same restaurant. But after a little while, friends of mine talked me into going there to try Missy's food, and I thought, what the hell do I got to lose? So I went, and I was, blown away. I was not surprisingly, she's great. She's a chef in full. The food is fantastic. It wasn't Andrew's food. It was her food. It was great. And then we did a piece on Missy, and at that point, she was the executive chef for both Avoce, Madison Square Park, and Avoce Uptown in Time Warner. And I remember while we were filming, there was a young girl there who was really exuberant, who was really stoked. She was on the line. And I remember talking to her. And I had a new crew then who weren't as fast as my old crew in some ways. We couldn't shift gears the way I liked to. It was kind of like driving a battleship rather than a little Porsche. And I just remember thinking we really should have interviewed her. She would have been a great story. And I just remember this big face. She was smiling. She was stoked. And I remember this. She was from Gravesend, which is... is that a part? I don't even know where that is. It's a part of Brooklyn that subways don't go to.
It is. It's true.
So she's here with me, Aisha Norjaya. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Aisha, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
So I'm going to ask. So I mean, Saul Bolton is one of my. I have so much respect for Saul. We did a. I think again, my first season, we did a piece on Smith Street in the early days with the grocery and Saul and Alan Harding. And I remember, out of all of those kitchens, just I really, as an older chef, I remember thinking, this guy's a pro. This guy's kind of. I don't want to say in my league or from my school, but he behaves the way I do in kitchens. It's real serious, real disciplined. It was real quiet. It was the way you run a kitchen. If you came up and he worked with David Boulay, so we all sort of worked with in and around the same people, more or less in the same era, although he's a little younger than I am. Talk about working with Missy, if you would. We'll start there. We'll go back to your childhood, because one of the things that I was really impressed about with Missy's kitchen, especially the downtown kitchen, Avoce Uptown was probably 50-50 or something in there, but the downtown kitchen at that time was all women.
It's very true. I started at Avoce Columbus as the sous chef, and then I was promoted to the executive sous chef, where I was bouncing back and forth. And primarily, I was uptown, but downtown was at least 80% women. Hillary was the chef de cuisine there, and it was fantastic. Uptown was another story. It was more of a boys' club, but Missy didn't run her kitchens like that. It didn't matter your age, you know what I mean? She was the boys' club. Yeah. You had to either be in her club or you were not in the club at all, which was fantastic. Avoce was another animal for me. I mean, I grew up in really great kitchens, and I was very fortunate to have met Missy. I actually met her through someone that I met at Felidia years and years prior to that. And when I got there, it was like 600 covers for dinner. Oh, my God. And this is what I'm in charge of. And it was like mind-blowing. But from the minute I walked through the door, she had this really great program for the sous chefs. It was 6 weeks. We learned from the scratch up. You had to do the bread. You had to do garde manger, each part of the line, before you were even a sous chef. She was like, don't even think about it. You're just, I guess, in my kitchen. Do as I say. Learn what I need. And in the 6 weeks, we'll sit down and talk. So Avoce was a great experience for
me.
It's
like boot camp.
It was extreme boot camp. It was like 6 a.m. to like midnight. Your wheels were spinning. There were so many things going on. And the food being done at that level for that many covers was really intense in a great way.
She was great. And you're right. And I remember Missy. I lived in the West Village, and I know she lived right off of Bleecker or on Bleecker Street. And I once in a blue moon, I would bump into her, really rarely. Anita Lowe lived in the same neighborhood, and I would see Anita on her bicycle because she worked in the neighborhood. Yeah. So there was a reason. But, I mean, Missy was 6 days or 7 days a week, 15 hours a day, and in charge of two restaurants that were just volume restaurants.
Seriously, she's a cut above.
She's a beast.
She is.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So where were you before Avoce?
Right before Avoce, I was at Pichelin.
Terrence Brennan.
Terrence Brennan,
great.
Yes.
I mean, a great kitchen in the sense that the food's great. A horrible kitchen to work in because the kitchen sucks.
Yes, it was very beautiful but very broken.
I remember like eating at that restaurant and saying, God, the food's so good. And then, you know, chefs always invite me back to the kitchen. And I'll go in and I'm like, you're fucking kidding me. You get that food out of this dump? I mean, it was like a 1950s kitchen. Beams in all the wrong places. There was no flow to the workload.
That's very true. Yeah, their suite was really not. I actually ended up there haphazardly. I opened that bar artisanal for him as a chef de cuisine there. And after a year and some change, unfortunately, the restaurant didn't make it. So I went up there. He didn't want to lose me as a person. And I got a phone call after a year being there from Missy out of the blue. And she was like, I heard you're the pasta girl. It's like, you might have heard right. And then that's how I moved from there. Prior to that, I was at Felidia.
Okay.
And that's really where my foundation was.
Which is a great. I mean, I think people, I've known Lydia, not terribly personally well, but I've known her for years. I actually knew her old producer that got her into television, Jeff Drummond, who's a great guy. But when people would ask me about Lydia, I'd say, you know, don't ask me about other TV shows because but I'll tell you something. Unlike 99% of the people that have TV shows, she's a chef.
She's a chef.
Grew up in Queens, had a restaurant, worked in the business. I mean, she was a chef at Felidia when the opportunity came to do a TV show, but she's in the kitchen. She's a chef. So just, no matter what you think or what you say, she's cut of that cloth.
I grew up watching her on TV, and when I first started working there and I saw her, I was expecting like this big grandma hug. I remember picking up the prosciutto that I sliced, putting it to the light, and throwing it in the garbage. And I was like, oh my God. This is not happening. You know, where's the grandma? What happened? And she's a businesswoman. I mean, a lot of the chops that I have now, I know that Sol came on and said, she's tough, came from that kitchen and watching her and really trying to emulate what this industry was about. You talked about gender before. I never looked at it like that. I was the only girl in that kitchen. And when I started, which I'm sure we'll talk about, like the chef, when I walked through the door, they were like throwing me out. And he was like, pastry, pastry, pastry. And when I got upstairs,
because he's an Italian guy, old school Italian, guy,
old school, it's right. Fortunato. He's definitely one of my mentors. And he was pushing me to pastry, and I was like, I'm going to make it upstairs. Mm-hmm. And when I was on Garmage, he's like, you're never going to make it to the line. And he's like, you're never going to learn pasta. And I started making pasta in the basement. But it gave me opportunities that I've never seen. I never felt like the gender situation. I knew they didn't want me there. They made me know that. But I think it was to toughen me in a way, a tough love situation. Not that
you're
a girl.
Brooklyn kid, right? Born and raised Brooklyn.
Gravesend, New York. Gravesend, Brooklyn. Where was I going? Yes.
Because, I mean, you talk about that. I remember having conversations off the record with Gabrielle Hamilton years ago. Because she kind of reluctantly came into the business. She actually had this great master's in fiction writing. You know, really educated kid who fell into catering because she couldn't support herself as a writer. And I remember talking to her about working on the line. And it was the kind of thing you talked about in a way that, you know, you're sort of competing with these guys. And you have to spit farther, drink as much, smoke cigarettes. I mean, you basically have to outdo men at the bullshit stuff.
You have to get into the boys' club.
Yeah.
You know, with your elbows pushing from side to side and let them know that you're there. And not that you're there because you kind of lose the girl in you. You have to in the beginning. Yeah. You get it back now at this stage. I can wear some mascara. I wear some huggy earrings as I'm working. But back then, there was none of that.
Yeah.
You were just one of them. And it was in that I really grew to be, thank God, who I am today. Very fortunate.
Who cooked in the family when you were growing up? Mom, grandma,
both,
everybody?
Both. My dad as well. However, I don't have that story where I grew up on the apron strings. I really didn't. I grew up in a great household with great food. I ate all the time. I ate everything spicy, even as a young age. It wasn't until I was older and I was watching Lydia on TV. I was in the paralegal field. I worked for Johnny Cochran. My parents were like ecstatic. She's going to go to law school. And then I just put the brakes on. And for some reason, I worked from 9 to 5 for Johnny Cochran. And from 6 to 10, I went to the Institute of Culinary Education. I'd eaten at Philadelphia many a times, but during your program, they tell you to go there and stage, and I went there. And remember, they stuck me in like a small spot, didn't let me do anything. And I watched this orchestra. It was 5 guys, 4 on the line, 1 on grand manger. It was a symphony that I've never seen before. They spoke nothing. My chef expedited to them in Italian, and they started putting up this beautiful food. And I was like, one day, I just want to be part of that. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it was. It doesn't seem glamorous from the inside out. And from the outside in, same way. But when you're there, and it's kind of like this silent thing going in a noisy, most chaotic situation, and beauty is coming from within, it was something that I knew that I needed to be part of.
Yeah, Lauren talked about the team thing, and that's an analogy that I used to make, too, was when you're watching, when you're working in a good kitchen, when you're on the line in a good kitchen, and you've got guys and gals to the right and left of you, and you're responsible for what you, I mean, you come in, you know what your mise en place is, right. You're ready for service on time, it's all spot on, and then the shit hits the fan, the dudes start coming in, and it just gets real quiet. It's like this big wave comes up, and you've got to stay ahead of it, and it really is like watching a team move. I mean, it's behind you, watch your back, behind you, hot soup, I'm on the back. But very little talking, a lot of concentration, and it's this beautiful kind of chaotic ballet that I think either you're drawn into it like you were and I was, because it just seems like, whoa, so that's how...
I want to do that dance.
I want in on that.
Exactly. Tap me in.
Right.
So that's how it was. It was the most phenomenal experience I had. I really moved throughout that restaurant in a way that I didn't know. And it wasn't, you know, everybody says to you, do what you love. Do you know what that is? I don't know if you do until you wear those shoes. And now I can say, I could not imagine doing anything else. I have great days and bad days. Some of them are really bad. But I do what I love every single day.
Yeah, it's true. And you have to. So tell us about Red Gravy. So Saul, did you work with Saul at all?
No. Saul and I actually met through a friend. And him and I had went to the waterfront near Atlantic Avenue. And we spoke. And he sat down. And I was just, first of all, I was like flabbergasted. I was speaking to like the godfather of Michelin cuisine in Brooklyn. Yeah. When Brooklyn was a nobody, he was there toughing it out on a street that was unsafe to walk on, let alone open a restaurant and get a Michelin star.
People don't remember what Smith Street looked like 15, 20 years ago.
That's very true. I was mesmerized by his passion and such a kind man. Yeah. No, I expected something else, just like anybody would. And he was so kind, so passionate. He had just come back from Italy speaking about food. And he spoke to me in a way, and I was very, very happy at Avoce. I had no intentions of leaving. And he was like, you know, I'm opening up this restaurant, and I heard some things about you, and I think you would be a great fit. And I was like, I love Brooklyn. That's my, Gravesend, that's my home. My friends are home laughing right now, but that's my home. And I guess one day I envisioned myself opening a restaurant in Brooklyn. But I was so happy at Avoce, and we were getting accolade upon accolade, and there was room for me to grow there. And he it was his mannerisms and his passion for food and his idealistic thing of like, you know what you're doing. I kind of see this vision, and together we can collaborate and make something amazing.
Talk to me about the menu, because I have not, as you know, I'm not going to lie to anybody.
Right.
I don't get
I'm
to
holding
Brooklyn.
It to it.
Yeah, see I have to. The subway goes both directions. I don't get to Brooklyn nearly enough. I live in Manhattan, and I'm kind of have trouble staying with the scene there because it's so evolving. But so in interest of full disclosure, I've not been to Red Gravy yet. I've heard great things. Talk about the menu and what opening is like, because that's such a brutal, I mean, people have never done an open, like, hello.
You have to do an opening if you've never done one.
Right.
And some people get on that high and stay on that high, and they just want to open restaurants. Other people are happy to check that off their bucket list and say, I'm done. So Red Gravy, we specialize in Southern Italian food. I take a lot of influences from Puglia, from Sicily, of course, Sardinia, Calabria. There's a lot of Calabrian chili everywhere. And we have fun with it. That's really the truth. We stick to Italian. I'm not one of those chefs that uses other things. Like, we don't use foams, and I have nothing wrong with that. I love them. It's just not me. My cooking is from the gut. Mm. I cook what I want to eat, and I cook what my passion translates to on a plate. And that's like that old time, like on Sunday we do Sunday gravy. We make the kit and caboodle. You know, it's an 18-hour sauce. It starts with pig skin and lots of fennel and onions.
Damn.
And then we have the lamb ribs, the brajol, the meatballs. And I'm missing something else in there, but it's a Sunday.
It's enough for me.
It's a Sunday favorite. You can hear it. You can smell it going down Atlantic Avenue. So that's what we do at Red Gravy. It's a neighborhood restaurant. I have a lot of background in fine dining, so you can't help see a little nuances of, you know, I'm not a tweezer girl. I love it, but I don't do it there. But we do everything in-house. We make all our pastas fresh.
That was my next question.
Yeah, every pasta we
so
make.
So it's funny. In a lot of New York kitchens, when I see pasta programs, I mean, I think I haven't been in Lydia's kitchen a long time, but I remember being in a lot of kitchens when a lot that work was being done these days by Mexican kids or South American kids who just have wonderful fingers, who can repetitive motion. They're really good. They somehow these guys have it. Who's in charge of your program?
Well, I oversee everything.
We
have one lady there, and I have Carla. She's our up-and-coming sous chef, and she does it 2 days a week, and I'm down there making sure that everything is going really well. Pasta is my passion. Like, if I have that hour of the day that I need clarity, I go down there and try to roll tagliatelle or make some kind of ravioli just to get your head straight. And at Felidia, it was one guy only. When I learned the recipe, they were like, we'll kill you if you tell anybody. Mm-hmm. I've never repeated it, nor have I ever made it ever since leaving there. Pasta is just a really, like, it's one of those things that's innate. I think you find your love for it, and not everybody can make it. Everybody can try, but, you know, at Maria, they do something that's simply insane. Beautiful.
Yeah. And there's, I mean, it's great to see that this is something that's new. I think in the last 15 years that Italian cuisine in America has just come such a long way. And a lot of it's been fueled by American chefs like Mike White, who grew up in the Midwest and traveled to Italy, fell in love with it, got the technique. And, you know, Andy Carmelini's an Italian name, but he grew up in Ohio. I mean, just a lot of Americans that just fell in love with this stuff, and it raised the bar.
It did, yeah.
So you got a great pasta program there.
Yeah, pasta program. We do everything in-house. There's one bucatini that I happen to like that I do import. Because I just think the dry, you need dry pasta in your life.
Yeah.
You can't. We dry our own pasta. We do that too. But sometimes you can't find product that you do. The Abruzzese Rusticella.
Okay. Yeah. Abruzzi's. They've always had great pastas from Abruzzi. And Gragnano's great. And Sitaro's
great. Sitaro's great.
Yeah.
I've tried theirs.
It's kind of
well.
It's what I do at home. I'm lazy. I don't make homemade pasta much at all. It's just if I got a box of good dried pasta, it's what I'm used to. What kind of meats are on the menu?
Right now we have braised pork cheek.
Damn.
We have striped bass. We usually try to keep fish, like equal amounts of fish and meat. So we have striped bass, monkfish, pork, braised pork cheeks, and venison. We run steak on some of the Piatto del Giornos, where one day a week we have a special amongst other specials. The front of the house wants to kill me every day. Like, chef, we can't go to the table and tell them 10 things. I can't help it. I want to create. And that's where we are. But we do interesting things. The neighborhood is great. They really are receptive. We have rabbit on the menu. We do wild boar sometimes. So we don't have to stick to the regular cookie cutter.
Was my next question, because you're in, I mean, the location is you're in a museum, right?
No, we're not. Saul's in the museum.
Saul's in the museum. Right. Oh, that's what happens. Right. So Saul's in the museum.
We're like the
sorry.
Peanut butter and jelly between Cobble Hill and Brooklyn Heights.
That's what Saul's. I'm
right.
sorry.
Right. Saul just moved to the museum.
Got you. So you're a neighborhood spot. You get people coming from Manhattan
all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. Thank God. And we have a lot of people that live there that work in Manhattan.
So what's your? I'm going to ask the same question. Sure. Just in interest of, you know, give everyone spread the love, because we got all sorts of different age groups listening to these shows. for cooks coming up, I mean, you know, you're like stone cold slap in the face. I'm going to talk to you like your mom or dad. Advice.
My advice is make sure you have the passion for it. Because the work, and you have a work ethic for it. Your love for food will die if that passion is not like one of those fires that doesn't burn out. Be serious about what you're doing. You know, my philosophy in the kitchen is 80-20. It's 80% common sense, 20% talent. Mm. I can teach anyone what I have been taught. But if you come into the kitchen and you don't know that you should have a towel in your hand, you know, don't touch anything hot, stay behind, don't flail your knife in the air, you know, don't talk back or, you know, not talk back, obviously, in a disrespectful way, but ask questions that are proper. Not, can I go see that concert, as you were saying before? You know, it was very different from when I grew up in the culinary industry. You went to work, you worked well above whatever hours you were intended to get paid for. You put your head down, and those are the ways that you got noticed. You worked hard, you went home and you read. You know, you took the subway there and fro. You better make sure that you read the Times on a Wednesday. That old subscriptions to Elle Magazine and GQ, whatever you had, you shredded. And you were just, you immersed yourself in the cuisine that, or in cooking, and to learn anything that you really wanted to learn. And I think now, you know, the idealistic thing about the chef right now is it's kind of like personified in a celebrity way. You know, I want to be on TV or I want to be on the radio. And those things are great. But those are accolades that come from hard work. I'm sure you don't take someone from culinary school, and maybe if you're doing a piece on that, then that's great. Be like, oh, what do you think about the industry? What do you know?
Nothing.
Talk to me when you worked at Michelin star restaurants, when you worked on the line 80 hours, when you come home with those scars, and you're taking this train from 59th and Lexington to Gravesend, and you're crying the whole time, not saying what did I do, but how do I get better? How do I get myself to a level where my peers from my left and right respect me the way that they respect each other? Those are things you should be thinking about.
Yeah, that's well put. I mean, that's if... You got to be stoked for this thing because it's going to eliminate any social life that you were going to have.
It does.
You end up hanging out with industry people because those are the only people that are.
You eat well. Drink better, but you eat well.
don't get me started. Yes, indeed. You eat well and you drink better. And do you find that same thing with that's because you had to go through a hiring process of, you know, finding these kids that are coming in. They just don't seem to have the commitment. They're staring at their smartphones on the line. They're looking out the window.
It's very true. I'm very fortunate. When I came to Red Gravy, Soul was like, if you have anybody, take them. And I have Carla and Andy work for me. They work with me at Avoce. I have a guy, Israel, that worked with me like 8 years ago at another restaurant. And we have a few new guys now that are coming in, and we're teaching them what I know. So I have a really small group, and it's a family restaurant, and it's a family-oriented kitchen. And that's really important because at the end of the day, you spend the most time with them.
That's the damn truth. That's the truth. Everybody better be comfortable together because it's stress, it's pressure, it's weekends and nights. Yeah. That's the only crew in the boat.
It's a pressure cooker.
How many seats?
70.
Address?
151 Atlantic Avenue between Clinton and Henry.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Very proud. We're looking forward to seeing you there.
Yeah, no, I've got to get over. I know, the subway runs in both directions.
You can take a cab. We'll pick it up for you.
My guest has been Aisha Noorjaya, who had a great story, great opinions, I mean a great resume, and I have to give a shout-out to Saul Bolton. You characterized him well. You know, there was a chef I worked with years ago. He was the bridge chef, and I was the night chef at Tavern on the Green. His name is Dominic Cerrone. He's an instructor at the CIA now, has been for a while. He's the French culinary in CIA. And Saul reminds me of him in that, unlike a lot of chefs, they're sort of volatile and hyperbolic and up and down and Dominic was very steady, actually soft-spoken.
Yes.
And almost quiet and thoughtful, but bored down into food. And Saul reminds me of Dominic like that. This is a guy, yes. I mean, I'm sure he's got a temper, but every time I've talked to him, he's very measured.
I think over the years, and he'll tell you this if you speak to him about it, he's learned how to kind of master that. Yeah. But when you speak to him, he's just a very kind, and he listens. You know, it's very, chefs, we listen. But we're always thinking as we're listening. And when you're talking to him, you can tell he's actually listening to what you're saying. So I really appreciate that. And it's nice to work for someone that has that.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Aisha Noorjaya, the restaurant's Red Gravy. Today's show was dedicated to women in the industry. We'll continue this thread from time to time as long as we have the show. Because I do think there's a million reasons. I don't know. Maybe it's just guys who jerk offs. We make a lot of noise and we hire PR people and always think we're the best, but there's a ton of women out there now. I could go on and on with this list of checking off boxes and names, but it's a growing trend. It's a great trend to see women as restaurateurs, women as chefs in the kitchen, it's only going to get better and it's only going to grow. So that was the end of today's food talk with Mike Colomeco. Stay tuned. We'll be back next week. Who are my guests next week? All right, I'll even tell you. I have it written down. I got Dan Silverman coming in. Dan's a cool guy. He was at the Standard for years. Now he's at the Regency. I'll have someone else with him. Two chefs. He's going to talk about what he's doing up in that big hotel uptown on the east side where they used to have that big power breakfast. That's next week's Food Talk with Mike Colomeco. Have a great week. Be well. I'll see you next week, folks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.